You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, welcome to Blogging Heads TV. This is Culturally Determined, and I'm your host, Arya Cohen-Wade. And my guest today is Natalie, who also goes by ContraPoints. Could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi. I am a YouTuber, and my YouTube channel is, as Arya said, ContraPoints. And basically what I do is kind of political commentary and some satire from a sort of left-leaning perspective in a kind of YouTube community where most of the people doing politics are very right-wing.
Yeah, so I want to talk about that in particular maybe a little bit later, but I first saw your videos when you were doing some interesting stuff where you're portraying different characters who are have different perspectives on the ideological spectrum. Could you talk about those videos and what it's like to try to inhabit arguments you don't agree with?
Yeah, so I first got the idea to do a video that had multiple characters, whereas most YouTube videos about politics, or most ones that I had done too, were just, it's a person talking to the camera saying what they think. But what happened back in January, I guess this was right after Trump was inaugurated, there was this viral video that we've all seen of Richard Spencer, the white nationalist, being punched in the face on the street while he was talking about Pepe. And I found that I was having a lot of arguments and looking at a lot of arguments on social media with other people on the left about the ethics of punching someone unprovoked, you know, if that person is a white nationalist and is publicly expounding their views. And I found I had very mixed feelings about it. And I initially was like, of course, no, of course you can't just punch someone, like, no, even if they are a Nazi. But I found that, like, other people gave me pause. So I sort of realized that I had mixed feelings about it. And one way to explore the mixed feelings in a video was to create two characters to represent two sides of the debate. And I found that actually this was a really good way for me to, I loved writing videos this way, because as I was doing the script, I would kind of come up with arguments and ideas that I don't think I would have come up with if I was not writing in a different character. So I guess I suddenly, like, understood why Plato did it that way. But, like, it actually does. Like, it gives you, like, it gives you new ideas that you wouldn't have had otherwise. And it's also fun. And you know, instead of, you could make a video where you say, like, here are my opinions about Nazi punching. I feel this way about this, but on the other hand, I think this. But you can also kind of make it more dramatic if you have people who are a little more extreme than that and who represent more extreme viewpoints, and those two can clash and you can kind of play that out. So that's how it got me started on doing that anyway.
And we'll link to some of your videos below where you inhabit different characters. So one of the characters is an alt-right person, yes. And Richard Spencer is the founder of the alt-right. So when he got punched, I also felt some ambivalence about it, because it was just emotionally satisfying to see this awful person get clocked. But reflecting on it, I decided that it is not a good thing for even morally repellent people to be punched on the street. So where do you come out on the whole Nazi punching question?
Oh God, I'm still sort of, like, if anything, I've become slightly more pro Nazi punching since January, because I think in part because of the Charlottesville. I mean, what I was sort of feeling at the, one of my thoughts at the time against, like, oh, this is not a good thing to do, is that, like, we should not be, like, escalating violence, right? We don't want to create a situation where there is this norm that, like, violence is an okay way to do, you know, or vigilante violence anyway is an okay way to do politics. But then this Charlottesville thing happened and people are dying and there's public intimidation in the streets and stuff. And it's like, well, we are already kind of at a state here where we've descended to violence. So I still think that, like, punching someone out of the blue probably is not okay. But I think that, or at least I've been convinced. So it took me some people had to convince me of this. And I've sort of been convinced that there are situations where, in the context of a, you know, fascist gathering of some kind, there basically is call for defensive violence. Or, you know, I know in Charlottesville, there's an article by this New York Times and Slate about how some of the civil rights groups that were there, the religious groups that were there, including Cornel West, say that they were protected from Nazi violence by Antifa forming a line, basically. So that, I mean, that's not the same as punching someone out of the blue. This is using force in a situation where force is already very much in play. So I think it's actually kind of complicated morally, but it's difficult to say that it's complicated morally because a lot of people on the in the center or on the right will even if you express any ambivalence about this at all, they'll say, "Oh, how could you express ambivalence about this? Isn't it clearly wrong to have violence, political violence?"
Yeah. So I there does seem to be a distinction to me between initiating violence and defending yourself. You know, if someone punches you, it makes sense to punch back, but someone who is not engaged in violence, initiating the violence seems wrong. I mean, the way that I've, where I've come down on this is just thinking, like, was Richard Spencer ultimately happy or sad that he got punched in the face? And I have to think that he was happy.
I'm actually not sure. But I don't know. I think maybe it's good. I mean, I think the Nazi punching conversation has been kind of good for the right, far right. Insofar as it's enabled them to create this story about leftist violence out of control, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, now maybe they'd be able to do that anyway. I don't know.
Well, it just seems like the Antifa ends up helping Trump and Fox News tell the narrative of chaos in the streets, you know, innocent conservatives being terrified, windows being smashed.
Yeah.
And it just seems like that is a way for reactionary politics to flourish when it seems like there's chaos in the streets.
Yeah, that's definitely something I worry about, and it's something that I'm working on a video now that kind of deals with some of that issue, the issue of optics. I care about optics, and I know a lot of people who are involved in Antifa-type organizing don't really care.
So one of the videos that you've made recently that I found most interesting was about gender dysphoria. And it's really more like a short film than just kind of a standard YouTube video, and we'll link to it below. I encourage people who are interested to check it out. Can you, and this is kind of a, you know, very personal topic, so if you don't want to discuss it, that's fine.
Yeah.
But you are very open in this video, and you've been very open about having gender dysphoria. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so on YouTube, I mean, if you look at my channel archive, you see that in these earlier videos, I was still, like, wearing dresses and things, but I was also all the while insisting that I was not transgender and saying that I was just a cross-dresser. And that's how I thought of myself at the time. You know, I didn't do that full-time. I would wear boy clothes when I was going shopping and things. But my feelings about that have shifted over time, and I realized that actually this was not just like a thing I was, it's not just a performance, it's not just a thing I like to do in private, it's actually just kind of my more comfortable kind of gender expression. So I went through a while where I was identifying as genderqueer, which is that my permanent destination. I'm kind of suspecting that actually it turns out that I'm just a trans woman, and that was a stepping stone. But I found that my dysphoria was getting worse over the course of this year, and kind of culminating this summer, which led me to make this video about it, where instead of talking about gender dysphoria as like an academic subject or in like a personal vlog style, here's my dysphoria and how I feel, I wanted to like not tell people what it was like, but show them what it was like.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided that the best way to do that was in a more of a short film type video that has like a kind of series of vignettes that gets some, that tries to communicate some aspect of the feeling of it.
Yeah, it's very effective, and I feel like you should submit it to like film festivals. It's just a very nice work.
Thank you.
So, what do you see as the difference between like, or how did you come to see like moving from cross-dressing to genderqueer to trans? Like, how did that work?
Well, it's funny because I know a lot more trans women than I used to know, because obviously. So I now recognize that this is actually a fairly standard pattern that people go, like, they, trans women will do this anyway. Like, it starts with like kind of cross-dressing and not really identifying as trans, or not necessarily cross-dressing, but other just like gender non-conforming behavior. And then genderqueer. So what does genderqueer mean? I mean, most people have no idea what that means. I mean, it means that you basically feel like this is one way of putting it. You feel some kind of alienation from both gender categories. So you feel that calling yourself a male or man or a female woman, like neither of those really you're comfortable with, mm-hmm. or you don't like those, you don't like inhabiting these roles, or you don't like thinking of your body or your expression this way. So that's definitely where I was, you know, 6 months ago. And I sort of have left it up in the air as to whether I still think of myself as genderqueer, because in some ways, you know, when you're new to transitioning, like you're not just going to start like being like, oh, I'm just living my life as a woman now overnight. Like it's kind of a weird woman you would be to has been a boy or and a young man for her entire life until mm-hmm. the last few months, you know? So there's definitely something odd about it. But I do think that with a lot of trans people, when they've been transitioned longer, they basically are at a point where they are living as their gender, and the fact that they're trans starts to have less of an impact on their life. So I'm going to sort of reassess when I have been doing this, when I'm further into transitioning, I'm going to kind of reassess and see if I think that I really basically am just living my life as a woman, or if I still feel there's some kind of like neither category that applies to me.
Uh-huh. So you had they, them as your pronouns on Twitter. Do you still identify that way?
Basically the reason I still have that there, first of all, I should say that like most people don't use they, them, even if that's what you want them to use. Like I mean, it would be great if we lived in the world where non-binary and genderqueer people, like everyone understands and accepts them and is happy to use they, them pronouns, but that's not the world we live in. Most people have not even heard of this, and learning new grammar for someone to a lot of people seems like this big toilsome request. So everyone just calls me she, honestly, but I know a few people who are in queer communities where they're more practiced using they, or they like to use they for everyone because they kind of like, in their communities anyway, establishing a norm of not having to gender everyone on site, for example. And I kind of support that idea. So, and I am perfectly comfortable with those people calling me they if they want to call me they. So that's why I consider it an okay pronoun to use. But for most people use she, and I just expect them to use she.
Mm-hmm. This is like, I saw a tweet just like an hour ago from Donald Trump Jr., about this, where it was something where some congressman proposed a constitutional amendment to ban burning the flag, and Donald J. Trump Jr.'s contribution was saying, if, you know, why is using the wrong pronoun a hate crime, but burning the flag is not a hate crime? So the pronoun issue does, like, it's, even though it's minor, and it's just these short words, it does seem to have, like, this totemic meaning on both sides, where it's very important for people who are gender non-binary or trans, but then it really pisses off people who are not sympathetic to those people.
Well, a lot of the opposition to the pronoun thing is based on this kind of this really inflated sense that, like, oh, we're being forced at gunpoint to use pronouns we don't want to. Like, that's the way it's usually characterized to me. But I don't know, as with the N-word debate, like whether white people can say the N-word, I find that the people who insist really emphatically on their right to say it are a little too interested in it to begin with. Mm-hmm. And I think my right to misgender people argument, like, it's not usually the people talking about it. It's not usually a reluctant concession to freedom of speech or something. Like, it's more like I demand upon not just my political right to misgender people, but also just the social norm of calling trans people whatever by whatever gender I feel like calling them. And to me, that feels like it's a kind of power play, right? To use a trans person's preferred pronouns is to admit that they are basically part of society, and that they are worthy of being kind of respected like everyone else. And that's to accept that there's something normal and okay about them. And if you don't think trans people are normal and okay, refusing them this level of respect, or refusing them this treatment is a good way to signal that.
Mm-hmm. How have people in your offline life reacted to your transition?
It's gone pretty well for me. I think my family was very surprised at first. I think that's normal. Like, so I'm 28 years old. That came out this year. So if your family has known you for 28 years as one gender and then you switch, like, it's going to, you know, it's going to take a long time to readjust. And they're supportive. They are readjusting. But there's this kind of difficult thing with coming out as trans where the people who have known you the longest, and in some sense, the people who know you best, are also the ones who are going to have the most difficulties adjusting. Because people, you know, I think gender is really a fundamental part of how we categorize the people we know. So when that changes, it's more difficult to get used to than like someone changing jobs or something. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like I have to have this like whole like shift in like the most basic way I categorize this person. And I mean, I think that's also why it's why the pronoun thing, for instance, is so important to trans people, because it's such a basic level thing, such a basic part of your social identity. But it also is why it can be hard to switch your pronouns, for instance. You know, like it's funny, someone I've known for a really long time, like I can go to a restaurant with them and like the waitress at the restaurant has no problem calling me she just on site. Or ma'am or miss, you know, but the person I with can't stop misgendering me.
Mm-hmm. That is a funny paradox. So you are a left-leaning person on YouTube, and I didn't really even realize until fairly recently, maybe within the last year or so, that YouTube is really, a political YouTube is really dominated by conservatives. Do you have any theories about why that is?
I have some ideas. I mean, I know there's been some articles written about it. There was an article, I think, in Salon about how the idea was that like there's something like right-wing and authoritarian about the act of talking to a camera. I don't agree with that. I don't see why talking to a camera is any more authoritarian than writing a think piece on Salon. But, you know, in either case, you just have a single author. I mean, I think it's partly to do with just historical accident. Like, it happened to be that YouTube picked up a bunch of right-wing people, and then that becomes a kind of self-perpetuating thing. So this seemed to happen around Gamergate. I guess maybe part of what it is YouTube is a popular site for gamers. So lots of people do Let's Plays and video game reviews and things. And so when Gamergate happened, this big controversy involving, you know, massive harassment and abuse of certain women in the gaming industry.
Yeah. If you don't know what Gamergate is, you probably are more mentally healthy than someone who does know what it
you,
is.
So. I envy you. Exactly. But a lot of the people who are big right-wing YouTubers now are people who kind of came up during this period. I mean, even people off YouTube, like Milo Yiannopoulos, the now mostly out of the picture right-wing pundit, he got famous as a journalist during Gamergate. There turned out to be a huge audience who wanted to hear about how women were ruining video games, and YouTube became the platform where a lot of that was said. I don't think that's the whole thing. There might be, because before YouTube, obviously talk radio was dominated by tends to be dominated by far-right people. But I don't think there's anything inherent about the medium of talk radio that makes it right-wing, right? Like, NPR seems to have no problem not being right-wing despite the radio medium. And so I think that you can do left-wing stuff on YouTube. I'm doing it, and some other people are doing it. It's just that it happens right now that the site is really dominated by right-wing men, especially some women too. And they have big audiences that are very hostile to people on the other side of the ideological spectrum. So this has been a big obstacle for people getting into YouTubing, who, especially people who want to do social justice kind of stuff, feminism, Black Lives Matter activism, any trans activism, anything like that. A big barrier to entry is that if you start doing that stuff on YouTube, your channel will be bombed by trolls, basically, who want to make your life bad and intimidate you off the site, in effect.
Yeah. Do you think there's something to, I've thought about the talk radio thing also, to like the single voice versus like a diversity or multiplicity of voices. So talk radio is classically like a older white man who is just spouting off for hours on end, and then the classic YouTuber is just someone sitting in their bedroom talking into the camera for some length of time. The site that we're on right now, Blogging Heads, is actually one of the sites that tries to bring people from multiple perspectives on. But you need two people, or it's kind of funny because you are doing something with multiple perspectives just through yourself.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think that there is an undeniable kind of correspondence between Rush Limbaugh, the older kind of angry white guy ranting on AM radio, and Alex Jones or Paul Joseph Watson or any of these other people on YouTube angrily ranting at the webcam. Now, that said, I mean, there are sometimes discussions like, and I do these debates also, usually on other people's channels. And I've, debated right-wing people before. Just yesterday, I did a video podcast with Sargon of Akkad, who's one of the biggest right-wing YouTubers. So I do it. And that does happen, but it's not most of what happens by any means.
Someone who I became friends with over Twitter, who's younger than me, I'm in my mid-30s, told me that leftists on Twitter are basically engaging in like a circle jerk, and YouTube is where the real action is because that's where young people go to get their information, and then they're being kind of radicalized by all the right-wing and alt-right voices on YouTube. Do you think there's something to that?
Yes, and God help us if YouTube is where young people are getting their information. But I agree that Twitter has a very big leftist community, and that, I mean, yeah, sure, it's a circle jerk, as right-wing YouTube is also a circle jerk. But I think that I basically do agree with that. Like, I think that what happens on YouTube is the algorithm of suggested videos can kind of start you off with fairly benign stuff, shoe on head making fun of Tumblr feminists, and then it from there a fairly benign video, it starts to recommend you other things, and then next thing you know, you're watching someone talking about how the refugee crisis is going to end Western civilization. And then you wind up with people talking about how women are inherently evil and are actually destroying the West from above. And I guess the deepest level is Alex Jones telling you the government is putting chemicals in the water to turn the frogs gay. And that transgenderism is actually a disease invented by Jews in order to stifle white reproduction so the Muslims can take over. And like, so, you can start with something pretty soft, and then within a few clicks, you're like in the deep, deep end. And I do think that it's like a radicalization pipeline.
Yeah, and that kind of lines up with the whole like red pill metaphor that like alt-righters and men's rights activists use of like, suddenly seeing the light and or the darkness, I guess, depending on what side you're coming from.
Right. That's exactly. So they use this term red pill from the Matrix, which, and they know, I mean, if you talk to the people who are the more moderate people in this group, they deny having any knowledge or involvement of being involved in any kind of radicalization pipeline. But if you talk to people who are at the extreme end of it, the Richard Spencers and so on, those people all say, like, yeah, like, it's useful to have these pretty right-wing people around because those people, like, wake people up to, like, white identity and these other sinister things that then, like, lead them into the hands of, effectively neo-Nazis.
So you have a Patreon or Patreon, I'm not sure how you say it exactly. How can you talk about how, like, that works in this new model of people supporting your content and kind of like the community around that's like built up around your YouTube channel?
Yeah. So the way Patreon works is an external website, not affiliated with YouTube. So think of it like Kickstarter, except for recurring donations. So the way I use it, basically people pledge a certain amount of money per video. So, $2 per video, $5 per video, $10 per video. And those people then pay me every time I upload a video and post it on Patreon. So this is very different from the way people until pretty recently mostly got paid on YouTube. The first wave of sort of YouTube celebrities or people to really make money on the site were all making money with ad revenue, which means that corporations not really affiliated with you post ads on your video. And that has a very different kind of an incentive structure as a business model anyway, than Patreon has. Because if you're making money from ad revenue, all that really matters is that people are clicking on your thumbnails and watching some of your video. So what you want is videos that are fast to make, easy to make, that have clickbaity titles and thumbnails, and are just entertaining enough that people want to keep watching your videos. So that, I mean, in my opinion, that's a terrible way to have, it has terrible results.
Yeah.
And that it doesn't really incentivize people to make higher quality stuff. It certainly doesn't incentivize people to do good research or anything like that. And so Patreon is different in that you're accountable to your fans, not to, so your goal is not necessarily to get the most clicks by any means necessary. It's, you want a lot of viewers, but the more important thing is that the viewers that you do have like you enough that they're actually willing to pay you to make more stuff. So I guess, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that your research has to be good, because of course you could just be telling viewers what they want to hear, and I'm sure people are willing to pay for that. But in my case, I've found that having people who are paying me to make videos, they want me to do good research, and they want me to be entertaining, and they want me to increase my production skills. And working on those things has caused me to get pretty successful on Patreon, which is very exciting to me, because I think this is a great way to make money online.
Yeah, it's a fascinating model. And has it enabled you to, in your professional life, like, devote more time to YouTube instead of whatever else you may be doing to put food on your table?
Exactly. So when I first started doing these videos, I guess I've had sort of like little vloggy YouTube channels off and on since, I don't know, 2008 or something. But I really got started with my current channel, and I guess it was April 2016, so a little, almost a year and a half now. And when I started, I was, I just finished a job as an adjunct professor, actually. But then I was picking up work as like a legal assistant and like a Lyft driver and just random stuff like this. And yeah, I was really limited in terms of how much time I could spend working on YouTube videos, because I had to be making money elsewhere. Now I'm doing this full time. So basically all my professional life is spent making videos, writing, researching, producing, buying props, editing, doing publicity things, live streams, a lot of time fighting with people on Twitter. you know, I don't know if that doesn't really count as work. I should do less of that. But it's really great as a creator to be able to actually make a living doing it. I don't know how I got this lucky.
Do you have any thoughts on the latest PewDiePie scandal?
Yes. So this is right. The most famous YouTuber.
Yeah. So I honestly did not really know who this guy was until fairly recently. Yeah. And I didn't even realize how to pronounce his name. I was saying a PewDiePie in my head. But then I tried watching one of his videos and I just didn't get it at all. It must be targeted to people who are much younger than me.
Yeah, I don't really get it either, but teenage boys, I think, in particular, love watching people play video games and talk about the video games while they're playing them. I don't really get it myself either, but it's huge. And PewDiePie is like a multimillionaire from the career he's made by having banter while playing video games. And I guess the controversy last week was he's playing some kind of shooter, and he says the N-word, and not just like, he said it in an aggressive way too.
And he's from like Sweden or something,
he's
right?
From Sweden, yeah. Okay. So he may not grasp the full significance of the word that it has in America, but also this is not the first incident that there's been with PewDiePie doing borderline racist stuff. There was an earlier incident where there were these two guys in, I forget where, India or Pakistan, and they said, you know, you can pay us and we'll write anything on a sign. So PewDiePie paid them to write "kill all Jews" on a sign and like dance around with this sign. So he was already kind of on thin ice as far as a lot of us were concerned with the racism. So then just the N-word popping out during a heated gaming moment,
Right. So that's what there's this weird guy. His name is Ian Miles Chong or Cheong, who is kind of like a propagandist for like the Gamergate people. And he excused it by saying it was a heated gaming moment, which is just such a absurd phrase that it launched 1,000 Twitter jokes.
Yeah. So what do I think about it? I think that, I mean, it's launched a whole debate about whether white people can say the N-word, which I don't know how this debate is being reopened. I thought this was settled, that no, we can't say it. But
every generation has to have its own can white people say the N-word debate, I guess.
Yeah, what just mystifies me is the fact that people seem so genuinely confused about why it's bad. Like, there must be some problem with people's education or something, that they don't understand American history and don't understand the implications that this word has. Or that, I don't know, people are very blissfully ignorant of, like, the history of race and even the current race situation in America. So they sort of, to them, it's just a word. Like, what's wrong with using just a word? And it's like, well, it's not just a word. It's a word that's associated with this history of violence and discrimination. And that's brings up a lot of very painful stuff for a lot of people. So when you're throwing it around angrily in heated gaming moments, like, maybe you don't have, like, deeply held racist beliefs. I'm sure you don't, but the effect of it is still bad, and it comes off as pretty racist.
Yeah, I'm guessing the fact that this guy is not American is kind of like the main, you know, cause of this. And for him, it was just an edgy joke kind of thing.
But in
the American context, it comes off much differently. But he has like millions of followers, and what is the appeal? Just that he is like kooky and does like pranks and stuff, or what?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure I'm the best person to explain why PewDiePie is popular. I think what I've heard from people, I haven't even watched that many of his videos, but I think he has a particular style. Like, I know like some of his videos that got really big were him playing horror games and then just reacting with comical fright and, you know, to scary things that happen in the game. And now everyone does that, of course, but, I don't know. I think I don't really fully understand why he's the one who's making millions of dollars doing this. I don't understand it myself.
Yeah, mysterious to me as well. Do you want to talk briefly about how you kind of like left academia to pursue other this current career?
So before I started doing YouTube as a job, I was getting a PhD in philosophy at Northwestern, actually. And I dropped out of that after 2 years. So basically, I did all my coursework and then decided I'm not spending the rest of my 20s writing a dissertation. I'm out. And I did end up sort of teaching a class after one of my old professors got sick, actually. They hired me as an adjunct to teach his class on Wittgenstein. So that was what I was doing spring 2016. But I was a philosophy PhD student. I basically decided that academia doesn't really agree with me. I was frustrated with various things, but in retrospect, I think my personality is just not really an academic's personality. Like, I think I'm more of an entertainer at heart, and I don't like spending all day in lecture halls, having discussions about Hegel. I just wanted to die if I was thought the rest of my life was going to be that.
Do you find that a background in philosophy is helpful in your current line of work?
Surprisingly so. I mean, I don't regret studying philosophy at all, because I think, there's a reason I trash talk philosophy all the time, but there's a reason I got interested in it in the first place. And that's when you're an undergraduate, you know, you're 20 years old, like, it's really exciting to learn all these new philosophers and like what they said. And you're kind of going all through history from Plato to like postmodernists, and like, it's like exciting to expose yourself to all these new ideas. But when you're at the graduate level, you're expected to really focus in, and you know, you're faced with the prospect that you could spend 3 years of your life or more being the world's leading expert on like the second half of a chapter of a book by a German guy who died in the late 19th century. And like, you lose some of the excitement then. And actually, it requires a kind of different type of thinking and a different personality type to want to do that, I think. So you have to be someone who's like kind of obsessive and who cares a ton about details and who really wants to work on this one problem for 3 years. And I don't have the attention span for that. I I don't know, the internet broke my brain too fat too early, and now I'm a YouTuber. So I do think that I like having the academic background. It's nice to be able to think about philosophy. And one of the things philosophy teaches you is it teaches you how to reason about moral and political issues, which is something that most people don't learn how to do. Like even people, a lot of educated people, like you learn the scientific method. So, you know, I think it's more common that people can think of, actually, it's not more common. I shouldn't say that. A lot of people can't think in terms of statistics well either, but it's a skill to be able to do moral reasoning and to understand like the different kinds of justifications that you can offer up for an action or the different kinds of reasons that kind of count for why something's bad or good. And also it just helps to have familiarity just with, you know, political philosophy, what the different viewpoints along the political spectrum are, like what kinds of justifications do people give for having those views. That's helpful to have. Even though the Wittgenstein stuff, this philosophy of language, has turned out to be, I don't say his name in YouTube videos because it's pretentious and bad, but like the video I did about what being genderqueer meant to me at the time, it's basically just like a Wittgenstein video without his name in it. Like it's a philosophy of language. Like what, you know, the question you're asking is, okay, what does it mean to be male or female? I shouldn't say male or female because to most people, they think these are just scientific categories. So we'll say, what does it mean to be a man or a woman in the social sense, right? Or the psychological sense? Well, you find that there's a cluster of things that it means and there's no like rigid boundaries. So that any like definition of woman that you give, you can find exceptions to that. And so this is like, it's related to Wittgenstein has this concept of family resemblance and that basically all concepts are defined not by a set of conditions, you know, anything that has three, you know, four legs in a seat and a backrest is a chair. You could think of all kinds of exceptions to that, toy chairs, stools, you know, there's things that are sort of on the outskirts of the concept. I'm talking so much about this, but
no problem.
The point is just that being able to kind of like bring that stuff back up, such as I'm able to remember it still when I'm having these internet conversations. Yeah, it's definitely helpful.
Cool. I think those are all the questions I have. Do you have anything else you wanted to discuss before we close out?
I guess that sounds like a good talk to me. I think I'm ready to close out.
Okay. So ContraPoints, thanks so much for coming on. All of our, you know, these videos are on YouTube now, so you can comment on YouTube, you can comment on Blogging Heads, you can subscribe in iTunes, you can subscribe on YouTube if you're a YouTube first 13-year-old who happens to be watching this. So thanks again for coming on. We'll
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.